You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this should be going out on the 11th of July, 2024. I received a call from an old friend, a man that I've known for over 20 years, Paul Angel, who remains the one of the editors of the Barnes Review and the graphic designer, one of the best, in fact. He's done the graphics of several of my books. Contacted me the other day and asked for a first-hand account of knowing the great Willis Allison Cardo. Apparently, they're doing an episode, or I should say an issue, on certain major revisionists over the years. And, of course, Willis being not a revisionist per se, but a financier. And since I worked for him for many years and remained in contact with him afterwards, he asked me. So some of you may know that I wrote an obituary when he died in October of 2015. That actually, if you go to Willis's Wikipedia page, is actually linked there, where I discussed my connection to him. And since I was asked to submit something, I expanded on that, on the legacy of Willis Allison Cardo, who died almost 10 years ago now, at the age of 89. Of course, when you read the establishment obituaries and the Wikipedia stuff, and it's mostly nonsensical, but I was shocked to learn that a lot of young guys, guys not that much younger than me, in fact, don't know who Willis Cardo is. And the quick and simple answer is that Willis is the reason there is any nationalist movement in America at all. William Pierce, in fact, took his National Alliance from Willis's National Youth Alliance. Willis was the organizational and financial center, going back to the 1950s, of this right-wing anti-globalist movement. Not knowing who he is very strange, and yet his legacy is being forgotten. And I only knew him at the end of his career, very long career, and he hired me right out of grad school. He was he introduced me. He brought me into a new world. I used to call him the Ozzy Osbourne of political figures because. While Ozzy Osbourne doesn't know the first thing about music, doesn't know music if it, you know, he doesn't even know where he is most of the time. And yet, for whatever reason, he knows how to pick and choose some of the best musicians on the planet. He has a sense about that. And his bands always were the best. He has an ear. And Willis was the same way. He wasn't a scholar or a writer and never pretended to be. But he gathered around him extremely talented people going way back to the 50s and 60s. And so being around him and the group surrounding him was a second education. He was a teacher, he was a mentor, but he also became a friend of mine. I knew him fairly well, in fact, and his wife, Elizabeth. He did not have children. In fact, Liberty Lobby, the Barnes Review, whatever, you know, many institutions that he founded over the years, many in his old age, were his children. But here's what I wrote, one of the things I wrote in his obituary that's now, you know, made its way around the web. I said, Willis Cardo's passing leaves a gaping hole in the nationalist idea, and I hesitate to call it a movement. Willis was a businessman, a practical thinker, a financier, and they're in short supply. We've had enough of the Haldol Hegels and the soul-poor Schopenhauers. These are not in short supply, and are, to be charitable, superfluous. Willis Cardo made it possible for many of us dissenters to earn a living doing what we love, and with luck, enlightening the world. He took on the pain of administration, finance, and the legal tediousness so that people like me can tell the truth without fear of going bankrupt. And that's exactly what he is. Of course, I would have no career without him. There's a lot of people, Michael Collins Piper, among many others, wouldn't have a career without him. Obviously, when I came out of grad school, the academic job market was not very kind to me, let alone that I was a white male, which knocked me out of most jobs. But given who I am, it made it that much more difficult. And Willis Cardo hired me right out of grad school. In fact, my first day was November 1st, 1999, and that's when my professional career officially began. And he made it possible for me to start writing on books and papers that, of course, I couldn't have written in the academic world at all. He was the reason I was both able to raise a family and have a normal life and stay within the heart of the nationalist and, of course, historical revisionist movement 24 hours a day. But without him, without anyone like him, that very, very sought-after circumstance can no longer be found. He was in the process of building what, you know, was a bona fide think tank, not the propaganda mills around the Beltway. Remember, this is all on Capitol Hill. One of the last publications he founded in the 90s was called the Barnes Review, named after Harry Elmer Barnes. I was hired in 99. Within a short time, I became editor of that journal. I was in my late 20s, early 30s. And despite the fact that Willis did maintain full editorial control, I had full freedom to pursue my academic interests, nationalism, post-Soviet Russia, and the reclamation of Europe. And unfortunately, and we'll talk about this here in a minute, the financial struggles of what used to be a very large publishing empire, I had to leave in 2005, completely out of everyone's control, had nothing to do with my performance or personal relationships, and in fact, I maintained excellent relations with everyone, and continuous to this day, publish in the Barnes Review. Several of my books, the one on the Soviet Union, the one on Putin, my very first book, published under the aegis of the Barnes Review. Willis, like me, was difficult and sometimes brittle. He made no claim to scholarship, but he would cross that line on occasion. When he did that, we fought, sometimes very harshly. But his personality was such that he quickly forgot those kind of battles. In fact, he considered it normal. Having an editorial staff and editors, well-educated people, for him, it was considered normal to have these well-educated, opinionated writers. That was part of the process in his mind, purifying what was going to become either nationalist or populist political doctrine, whatever word you wanted to use. Not only did he respect it, it never became personal, of course, but he required it. And it was quickly forgotten. It was never personal. Again, from that same obituary I wrote, I had to always remind myself that Willis is the reason why any political nationalism exists at all in the U.S. The Liberty Building on Capitol Hill was his. I was just a temporary occupant. From a single desk, the National Press Club, Willis created a publishing empire over several continents and angered almost every powerful interest in the cosmos. Willis could be difficult, he could be stubborn, but I took it without too much complaint, since he had earned that right. Well, I complained all the time, actually, but still, the point remains. He earned it. More than once, in fact, he built a publishing empire under the disapproving glare of every organized interest in America. Unfortunately, they were not his worst enemies. I learned a lot of lessons there. It was the other so-called nationalists or paleoconservatives that, envious of him, the fact that he was able to employ people full-time, he was betrayed over and over again. Some of these people would rather live in the gulag before taking orders from someone. But he overcame all of these obstacles and was active practically right into the day he died. He had extraordinary practical insight, but his reward was endless gold digging, betrayal, hatred. For those like me, of course, he earned quite a bit of respect. One of the central figures, at least when I was hired, even more well-known than Willis himself, was Michael Collins Piper, who died the same year, 2015, and was a close personal friend of mine. He wrote a book, wrote many. He wrote a book called Coup d'Etat, subtitle being The Bizarre Inside Story of How an Intelligence Operative Tied to the CIA and Israel's Mossad Orchestrated the Takeover of the Institute of Historical Review and Set in Motion the Ultimate Destruction of Liberty Lobby. Very long subtitle. And I have a signed copy of it. I have signed copies of all of his works. And he goes into great detail exactly what happened and just the significance of what could have happened had a group of people out in California not attempted to take over. October 15th, 1993. It was a violent fight erupted at one of his flagship organizations, the Institute for Historical Review, out in Costa Mesa, California. It was meant to be the Revisionist Research Institute, which he established in 1978. And what happened on that day set in motion a chain of circumstances that completely destroyed the empire that he would have created. Not just the Institute, we know it as the IHR, but Liberty Lobby, the Spotlight. And when all of that dust cleared in his old age, still founded yet another publication, the American Free Press, that continues to function today. The Barnes Review continues, although with a skeleton crew to publish. But the IHR affair, the destruction of Willis's investments in California, showed just what a threat he really was. People don't realize that he had 400,000 paid subscribers to the Spotlight in the late 70s. But there was an actual long-standing conspiracy of envious people as well as our enemies that destroyed it over time. Now, Liberty Lobby, he founded back in the 50s, actually meant to be a middle-class, white, patriotic lobbying organization. Also meant to be a source of information, essentially a clearinghouse for right-wing nationalist efforts around the country. Now, the Spotlight's actual weekly readership, because it was one of these publications that had a high pass-on rate. In other words, one subscriber would give it off to several people. So you're talking about more than a million people who got their hands on each of them. The IHR had a publishing arm called Noontide Press, and that operated under a nonprofit called the Legion for the Survival of Freedom, LSF. That was founded by Jason Matthews in 1952. That actually was one of the things that published the American Mercury, Mencken's publication. Willis Cardo, in 1966, assumed the debts of the American Mercury after Matthews' death and took over the Legion for the Survival of Freedom and then created the publishing empire that eventually led to the Institute for Historical Review and the Barnes Review eventually. He also bought the Washington Observer, but it wasn't until 1979 that he established the Institute for Historical Review as a subdivision of the Legion for the Survival of Freedom. So he owned and brought under one a person, even though it was not a personal form of ownership, several very different right-wing and historically revisionist organizations and publications. That's where what we call historical revisionism, especially over the Holocaust and World War II was concerned, first began. Willis was its financier. When I say revisionism, I'm talking about upending the leftist view of the world, whether it be in the Bolshevik Revolution, the Jews, the Holocaust, World War II, World War I. The IHR had a tremendous scholarly track record. The Journal of Historical Review published for a long time. The Jewish Defense League firebombed the IHR office in Torrance, California on July 4th of that year. U.S. law enforcement said it was a professional operation. They tried to destroy the library. The California law enforcement said it was in a foreign and intelligence-based operation. In other words, it came from Mossad. And the book inventory, worth over $1 million, had been destroyed. But typical of Elizcardo, it didn't stop him. He raised the money again, and everything was put back in place in a fairly short period of time. Many of you may have heard of the scammer Mel Mermelstein. He is one of these Holocaust survivor characters. He tried to sue the Institute for Historical Review on various grounds. One of it was they offered, I don't know how much money, I think it was $100,000 for anyone who could prove that anyone had been gassed at various camps. And he filed, in fact, several lawsuits. And he claimed to have evidence that, in fact, he didn't have. Well, it was a deliberate set of lawsuits. He was financed by others, and it drained the IHR. He hired a very well-known attorney, Mark Lane, and William Holsey, and eventually defeated Mermelstein in 1991, admitting defeat even before it went to trial, but it cost a fortune. So 1993, when his lawsuit collapsed, Michael Collins Piper has a book called Best Witness on this phenomenon. That revisionism now at this point was a force to be reckoned with. Now, Willis generally didn't interfere with the day-to-day operations of things, and that went for my time there as well. He had a great confidence in his staff. He essentially was an unpaid advisor, especially when it came to things like administration. One of the researchers and translators named Ted O'Keefe, who was the editor of the Journal of Historical Review, began to fall behind. Michael Collins Piper writes that he was unable to meet deadlines, and he had to leave. And he gave his position over to Mark Weber, who was hired in 1991. That Willis eventually said that these men were very stubborn, very hard to work with. And Mark Weber was going to be replaced as well. And he hired Tom Marcellus, as well as Greg Raven, a libertarian, which is just a red flag as it is, to take over. Ted O'Keefe was supposed to write the book on the Mermelstein case, and he did not, either whether he could not or refused, and Mike Piper eventually wrote it. And it was going to sell very well. It was ultimately published in the spring of 1994, but the group of people that I just mentioned apparently were in the process of attempting to take over and then eventually destroy what Willis had built in California, as well as Liberty Lobby, which was in Washington, D.C. There was an attorney named Andrew Allen from San Francisco. He was ingratiating himself with the staff at the IHR, claiming to be a revisionist, was exploiting the dissatisfaction of people like Mark Weber and O'Keefe. He claimed to have been a revisionist and everything, but he was, in fact, undermining everything. Turns out he was CIA, as Michael Collins Piper proved over and over again. A man named David McCulden was fired from the IHR, and anyone who was removed from those positions were hired by the likes of Allen. A guy named Roy Bullock, who turned out to be a employee of the ADL in the book called The Garbage Man. And Allen, Bullock, McCulden launched a propaganda campaign against the IHR. And Michael Piper shows in great detail that all of this came from the CIA middleman by the name of Elliot Carter. Because of all of this, Willis Carter had barred these men from IHR conferences, especially Allen. Weber, O'Keefe began collaborating with Allen during the summer of 1993. And they were in contact with William Holsey, the former attorney, who had been dismissed after the Mermelstein case, and he had been paid over $100,000 for what he'd done. After the victory party over the Mermelstein case, to the chagrin of the judge, Stephen Locks, there was a confrontation between Halsey and Mark Lane. He probably had been drinking, but there was a stunned silence there. A few people had excused themselves. Halsey turned out to have been funneling information this whole time on Willis and these organizations. All of these men were promoting Weber and O'Keefe as the real Institute for Historical Review, and to now take it over to remove Willis Cardo from his position. And, of course, in the process, completely destroy it. The two other staffers, Marcellus and Greg Raven, were also involved here. And there was an agenda that at the time, no one was quite sure what was happening. And this was set in motion, a set of events that would destroy this organization. October 4th, 1993, Willis received a letter that was signed by the director, Tom Marcellus, the editor, Mark Weber, the assistant editors, Ted O'Keefe and Greg Raven. These were paid employees, that Willis was no longer welcome at IHR headquarters. None of the Cardos, in fact. Willis eventually found out that senior members of the board of directors, the Legion for the Survival of Freedom, Lewis and LaVon Purr, had resigned. He discovered that this cabal, along with William Halsey, had put them under tremendous pressure. In fact, legal prosecution, if necessary, if they didn't join Marcellus in their coup. There were various threats against them. The Purrs resigned, and then they later repudiated all of this. It was done under duress in court. And in fact, Halsey was the man who first called it a coup d'etat. And we're talking about an organization with a lot of money here. They created a new board member. They told each other that they were they're going to bring this into a new era. The rest of the board members, like Sam Dixon, had been completely misled. And they brought in Andrew Allen and John Curry, all of a sudden become board members. Completely bogus, saying that now Willis and Elizabeth were persona non grata. Cardo had to do something about this. As this is all going on, they had neglected to pay any rent in the buildings of the IHR out in California. They changed the locks. And Willis eventually showed up, got into the building. He sent a very nice fax to Halsey's office saying, look, I'm back. I'm in this office. I've taken physical control of it. This group that I've mentioned arrived at the IHR office, and Willis and Elizabeth were physically attacked by them. Halsey, Marcellus, Weber, O'Keefe, and Raven, armed, forced their way into the building and violently ejected both Willis and Elizabeth. They were both battered and bloodied. It's a semi-automatic. Raven aimed it at Elizabeth Cardo's face, screaming at her to get out. And if you know Mrs. Cardo, you realize what kind of personality she had, and her response, now famous, said, well, you'll first have to shoot me, you coward. And Raven did not fire. Eventually, they were physically thrown out of the building. Remember, Willis was a very small man. They landed on the sidewalk. And Willis had grabbed on to the railing, refusing to leave, and they were started to beat him. Willis said it was getting a little bit uncomfortable, so he finally had to let go. They were now bloodied in the street, not allowed in these offices. Someone called the cops. Willis told the cops that Raven had the weapon. The gun was hidden, but they eventually found it. In fact, there was one bullet in the chamber, so they were going to shoot him. And everyone ultimately was arrested. Willis wanted to stop it right then and there. Willis said that if this bunch wouldn't have them arrested for trespassing, whatever they were going to do, they would do the same. Halsey said, only if you give all the assets over to me. And he said, to go to hell. That's why everyone ultimately was arrested. He was placed in jail. $50,000bond. Jim Townsend, the publisher of the National Educator, paid for their release around midnight that day. No charges ultimately were ever filed, but litigation followed, as you might imagine. Tom Marcellus turned out to be a leftist of sorts. A lot of these guys ended up abandoning everything that Willis had trying to do. And one of the worst things was to abandon the series of books by Leon Degrelle, the SS commander, French-speaking Belgian. The Barnes Review ended up publishing all of this. The most decorated combat veteran on the Soviet front. Campaign in Russia was published by the IHR. Hitler Born at Versailles was very popular, and this series was going to be expanded. And this group, who had taken over now, refused to continue it. Marcellus kept saying that this is not a pro-Hitler organization. We can't have Nazis here. All kinds of things. The book on the Lehr Plan said we're not going to support Nazism anymore. We're not going to republish Theodor Kaufmann's book and all the rest of it. The point was to take over everything and to abandon it, simply not do anything, which is why they never paid any more rent. We're going to stop Willis Carter because he was a Nazi and a racist. We can't have any pro-Hitler works anymore. Turns out that all this time, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, had the Noontime Press's mailing list. Their publisher. The Noontide list was turned over to the ADL even before all of this happened, so there was someone there working with them. There was a so-called right-wing file. This is the ADL spy, Roy Bullock, was a part of this. Contained the names and sometimes personal information of everyone who had ever bought anything or subscribed. That was sent to the ADL and ultimately to Mossad. Someone there, more than one person, in fact, was working with the Anti-Defamation League. Maybe David McAlden, who's since died, so never be known. But they spent a fortune attempting to regain control of the IHR throughout 93, 94, etc. Robert Polis, ruled against them, ruled against Willis Carter. But to tie this all together, there's another big part of this, and that is Thomas Edison's fortune. What was at stake here, and what was only known in later years, was that Willis Carter was going to be in receipt of the huge fortune of Thomas Edison, who his son and his great-niece, who was the one who, Jean Farrell, who possessed it, was going to leave this fortune to them, to Willis Carter, Liberty Lobby. Hence, he was going to be able to create a massive and wealthy think tank. Of course, the regime couldn't let that happen, and this is why the coup ultimately took place. That's why, when they took over, nothing ever happened. Andrew Allen and all the rest of them, this was their motivation. They believed that they had to keep Willis Carter from taking any of this money or using any of this money. I think they said it was $80 million. I don't know what the exact amount of money was. Her name was Jean Edison Farrell. Charles Edison, who was a former governor of New Jersey, who was the son of the inventor, were longtime supporters of Willis, longtime supporters of Liberty Lobby going back to the 50s. In fact, Governor Edison was one of the founding members of the Liberty Lobby Board of Policy Members. They knew each other very well, Willis and Elizabeth. So shortly before her death, Jean Farrell, who was living in Switzerland, approached Willis Carter and told her, I want you to have this money and to do, you know, have a radio show and build the think tank with this. She died in the fall of 1985. In addition to those arrangements, she also had a handwritten will that bequeathed her personal effects at her home in Switzerland and a lot of money in a safe deposit box there, to a neighbor who had promised in return to expedite the transfer of her assets to Willis. Now, it's a stupid thing to do, because the neighbor in question hired a lawyer and laid claim to everything. Of course, he was not acting alone. The deceitful neighbor was an actual Zionist working for the ADL. The whole thing was a scam, and poor Jean Farrell was a victim of it. Her death was a bit of a mystery to Willis. He didn't even know about it until a month later. And the regime was extremely upset. This neighbor received tremendous financial backing from the Anti-Defamation League, etc., keeping him from ever taking control of this estate. We did have a source in the State Department who I don't know. This is just before my time. I was hired when this was all over. That Willis was under very close surveillance by Mossad. Mossad knew of Farrell's death long before Willis did. They panicked at the idea of Willis Cardo having this huge amount of money and what he was going to do with it. Willis lived a very austere life. He was going to put every penny into hiring scholars and building a think tank, you know, with radio shows. And of course, he didn't really know the web. This is 85. But all of this today we would call social media. And the litigation began. This is what the takeover was all about. Very little of this money ended up being left after these battles in the courtroom. This money alone was exhausted after 5 years of legal contests, international legal contests. Only a trickle ended up going to Willis. And at the same time, the Rummelstein case is going on, which was no coincidence. And it wasn't that long after the JDL set the place on fire. Some of the money, though, was created the Sun Radio Network, run by Tom Valentine. Tom Valentine was the very first guy to ever interview me. Wait, I don't even remember when that was. And the group of people, Mark Weber and everyone at the IHR, has done absolutely zero since all of this was done. In other words, they had no intention of publishing or really doing anything. The website has remained unchanged for a decade now, something like that. That's what Willis Cardo was going to do. But even failing that, still created by far the largest nationalist enterprise, 70s, 80s, 90s, than in my era, that anyone's ever put together. He was able to steer us away from the weirdo polyester-clad, you know, patriot crowd. You know, the idiot who thinks that the Chinese are going to invade California, this type. I used to call them Seroquel Spanglers. Being the Ozzy Osbourne that he was, he knew how to separate the wheat from the chaff in this regard. We learned really quickly what the Dunning-Kruger effect really was. Willis is the reason that I have a career. He was the one. I had to convince both Michael Collins Piper and Willis Cardo back in 2001-2002 that Vladimir Putin was a huge threat to the globalist regime. Nobody was saying that at the time. They disagreed with me at the time. He was just considered a Marxist of the old Soviet school. Once I started publishing on this, I was lambasted by everybody. Today, of course, thanks to those two, who I convinced Putin was a good guy in many respects. And they even published my book on the topic. They put his picture on the cover of the Barnes Review not too long afterwards. That's why anybody views him as a nationalist or Eurasianist figure. He gave me the tools to do this. Both the Barnes Review, both my book and this lengthy article I put together on the front page, which has altered American politics. No one had considered him that way before I came around. In fact, I completely altered how nationalism viewed Russia and hence how the world viewed Russia. In fact, Willis was also the first person, and I didn't have to convince him of this, that the China, Peking China, not Taiwan China, is a national socialist government, not a communist one. Point being, that even when he disagreed with me, he still provided those he trusted with the resources to prove him wrong, and I did. Those were some of the main things that he operated by. So when the coup took over, and they simply used lawfare, probably the first time this happened, to attempt to destroy him, they knew exactly what they were fighting against. Whether it be over the Edison estate or anything else, the Rummelstein thing, Mossad was well aware of what this man was and what this man could do. He wasn't one of these screaming polyester idiots, you know, with the Schofield Bible talking about Israel in the end times. Not a scholar himself, He didn't have a tremendous practical insight and common sense. In 1980, Liberty Lobby had 200 employees. He had two accounts. And once the smoke kind of cleared, that's when I was hired. What was left of that Farrell estate, which was very little, near the end of his career, I was hired. And of course, I knew that the organization didn't have much time. But there was still a substantial group in Washington, D.C. when I was hired. And it didn't change him. What we know, but we put together the intellectual scaffolding to understand globalization, comes from people that he put together, comes from his institutions. Common sense to him, the practical, being able to put something together to organize the unorganizable, that was his great talent. Understanding the role of Zionism, this ultimately comes from Willis, practically from the foundation of the State of Israel, right up until the day he died. Warfare and propaganda, those are the only two arrows in the regime's quiver. Then he let us, the scholars that he hired, fill in all the details. He was well aware that he couldn't put it all together, but he knew the people who could. I'm going to go back to when I found out about his death, and affected me very, very much personally. Here's what I wrote to his enemies. I don't care where they are on the political spectrum. Here's what I wrote to them. You mindless, conformist, groveling, cliche-spouting, superficial, shallow, TV-soaked, nihilistic, antisocial, brainwashed automatons have no idea what has begun here. Willis is not dead. Rather, the small army of scholars, writers, editors, activists, and troublemakers that Willis has trained now has been unleashed against your Soros paycheck existence. In your stupidity, you think that since one man is dead, the idea dies too. That's typical of your irrationality, your shallow pathology. The truth is that we are far tougher, more knowledgeable, and more fearless than even he was. We have almost nothing to lose, yet you guys have never heard the word no before. That's a mix that's going to lead you to the rubber room. I personally guarantee you that there's no way the debauched, corrupt, conformist university system can churn out the requisite number of self-esteem counselors to put your brains back together when we're finished with you. You're beneath us. Your sophomoric, shallow, pedestrian ideas need to be protected by university speech codes and safe spaces. You're soft, you're entitled, you're overindulged and irresponsible. And you've long reached the peak of your mobilization, and yet we are just beginning. And of course, as things have gotten worse since I wrote those words, I stand by them today. Willis's legacy can be found in that his organizational skill laid the groundwork for the regime's defeat. Yeah, your typical patriot is no intellectual threat to anyone, but what Willis Carter put together clearly and obviously was. Willis did what was almost impossible. He organized that which was unorganizable. A bizarre set of eccentric personalities that together create some sort of a functioning nationalist movement, or at least the intellectual scaffolding, as I've called it. It's no small feat. Unfortunately, his legacy is being forgotten, and young people don't even know who this man was. And it's also unfortunate that today no such institution, no such financier exists. And this is why Willis is missed, and that is his legacy. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.